Counsel?
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Mary Swift here on behalf of Mr. Wilson. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Proceed.
The state has conceded Mr. Wilson must receive a new trial on the attempt conviction because of the missing attempt instructions. The state has now further conceded the ER 404B evidence was admitted in error, which requires a new trial on both convictions given the prejudice that resulted from that evidence. Unless the court has specific questions for me on that issue, I will rest on the brief and ask that this court accept the state's concession. With that, two issues remain. Going to the first, our contention is Mr. Wilson's words alone are insufficient to sustain the conviction for attempted child rape. Basically, there's no evidence of a substantial step strongly corroborative of Mr. Wilson's criminal purpose. For that reason, we're asking the court to dismiss the attempt conviction and remand for a new trial on the remaining conviction.
She was alone in a bedroom with him?
So, going to that point, Your Honor, the state argues repeatedly in its briefing that Mr. Wilson isolated B.E. in the bedroom, and the record really doesn't support that. What the record shows is that B.E. shared this bedroom with Claudine and Mr. Wilson, and so all we know is that they were in this bedroom together. There's really no evidence like we have in the Jackson case where you have an enticement or a ruse to enter the bedroom, following in there, cornering, any type of conduct or act suggestive of his criminal purpose.
We need to infer from the evidence, though, that they were alone?
Perhaps, viewing all the evidence in the state's favor, she doesn't say anybody else is in the bedroom, but again, this is a bedroom that they shared. And so you don't have the type of conduct corroborating the criminal purpose that is isolating or lying in wait or following suggested by the Jackson case or suggested by the model penal code.
Should we infer he has exposed himself?
No, Your Honor, that's nowhere in the record. All we have are his, basically the location of where this happened and his words to her.
He's giving her explicit directions. Is it likely that with a child of that age, he would give explicit directions to do something which was not present before her? That is to imagine something that she wouldn't have otherwise experienced.
At that point, Your Honor, I think we're really reduced to speculation, which is not sufficient for an inference in the state's favor, which is necessary for the standard on appeal. We don't have any evidence of him exposing himself to her, any sort of gesturing. Perhaps if he had invited her to lie down on the bed next to him, that might have been a substantial step. We have nothing like that. And I filed a statement of additional authorities last night, which I recognize is an unpublished case from this court, so it's not controlling, but it basically discusses the rule in Washington that solicitation alone doesn't establish an attempt crime. And solicitation not meaning the term of art in terms of offering money to somebody, but solicitation of inviting somebody to engage in a crime.
Well, did he invite
her? If that's
an
unpublished opinion, what does it rely on for that proposition?
It relies on State versus Gay, which recognizes the same proposition, as does State versus Grundy, which I've discussed in the briefing, which recognizes that solicitation, in other words, inviting somebody to engage in a crime, is not enough for an attempt crime in Washington.
Is it a fair characterization that it's invitation, though? I mean, you said directing her to lay down on the bed as in an order. Here, he's directing her to engage in oral sex with him, and he says, in a declarative statement, he does not say, would you like to? Her testimony was, he told me to.
Again, Your Honor.
And he is an adult in a position of authority over
him. Again, I would emphasize that Washington courts have time and again recognized that solicitation or, invitation, however you want to phrase it, a request to commit a crime is not enough for an attempt. We've agreed that this...
I agree with you. I'm just asking if that's not a request, but in fact a directive from an adult in a position of authority. and if that makes a distinction.
I don't think that it does, Your Honor, given that we're lacking that conduct. The Sivens case says any slight act done in furtherance of a crime. And what the cases in the briefing draw a distinction between basically the communication, which establishes the intent, and then some type of conduct corroborating that intent, whether that's driving to the girl's hometown or following her into the bedroom, cornering her in the bedroom, any slight act to corroborate that criminal purpose. And I think that's really important to remember here, because the state is arguing that this would have been a completed act but for the fact that she said no. But I don't think that's true without this some type of corroborating conduct. We don't really know how this would have played out had she said yes. As I've argued in the instructional section, that these words could have been intended to annoy or harass her, or simply been just inappropriate, which we're not disputing that they're not inappropriate, but they're encompassed by essentially the crime of communication with a minor for immoral purposes. This court can imagine any number of circumstances, somebody passing someone on the street and says some sexual remark to that person, that doesn't turn that into an attempted rape. It might be harassment at that point, but there has to be some type of conduct beyond that invitation to engage in criminal activity to establish that substantial step. With that, I'll wait for
you
rebuttal.
You said there was a second issue. What was the other one?
Oh, it's the doctor's testimony linking BE's obesity with sexual abuse.
But we don't need to reach that since we're sending it back.
Well, that would be an issue that could recur on remand. So we'd still ask this court to provide guidance to the trial court on that issue, since the trial court had overruled defense counsel's objections on that point. Thanks.
Good morning. Could please the court. I'm James Westman, representing the state of Washington in this matter. I'll focus my remarks mostly on the attempt count also, although I can certainly answer the court's questions about the other issue if the court has any. I think that the argument that counsel just made was a reasonable argument that could be made to a jury, but the standard now is, could any rational trier of fact have concluded that this defendant's comments to this young girl constitute an attempt? And I think the answer is clearly yes. As Judge Applewick's comments indicate, you have an adult male in a bedroom alone with a 5-year-old, and he says to her that he wants her to suck on it like a sucker. I don't know in that context how you can get any closer or what more step must be taken between to constitute a completed crime.
Do you have a case that supports the idea that words without some sort of conduct is enough?
I'm not aware of any case that says that words alone can be sufficient, but I would point out that you don't have just words alone here. You have the context. So his a directive in this context, I think, is sufficient for the jury to conclude, for any reasonable juror to conclude, that he had taken a substantial step.
When you're saying
what was the substantial step that he took?
The substantial step was directing her to suck on his penis like a sucker.
But there must be something else if you're agreeing that solicitation, invitation, isn't enough. So you're saying that he just was, though, because of who he was and where they were.
Yes, that's a substantial step towards having sexual contact. You know, the elements of the offense are you have to have sexual contact between his genitals and her oral contact, and that's a substantial step towards making that occur. That's all the jury has to find.
Asking her to do it.
Sorry?
Asking her to do it.
Directing her to do it.
Directing her to do it.
Yes. And in this context, it is a directive. This is an adult talking to a 5-year-old. It is not drug negotiations on the street where you have some banter back and forth that usually precedes and an event may or may not follow.
What were the exact words of the testimony that you say amounted to him telling her to do that?
She testified, or she said to the forensic investigator on the exhibit, so the DVD that you have, that he told me to, quote, suck it like a sucker. And remember, this is in the also in the context of her also saying that Papa had sex with me. So the jury has all of that testimony. The jury has that particular testimony. And, you know, the context is critical here. It's not as though he's saying this over the phone. He's not as though as he's saying this 6 months before. He's saying this in a moment where they are face-to-face. We obviously can't say if they're feet apart or inches apart or whatever, but they are face-to-face, a five-year-old and adult, and he says that to her. In that context, a reasonable juror could conclude that he'd taken a substantial step towards having oral and penile contact with her.
But this is a different event than her other description of the rape.
That's correct. Different. That's correct.
And she's clear that this is a separate time.
Yes. Okay. But
follows,
I don't think...
It follows the other event, so she knows what she's talking about. What he's talking about when he says do something to his spot.
Presumably, yes, Your Honor, although I'm not sure that it's possible to say from this record for sure which event occurred first.
Is that right?
Because I don't think she was specific enough as the dates. I think that she tied this event to November, and I don't remember if she tied the other event to a specific... No, I'm sorry. The other event was to November. I don't remember if she put a specific date on this one. But still, I think the overall context is this is in a relationship where these things are occurring, and I think that's a reasonable inference for the jury to draw. But even if you leave the temporal aspect aside, you know, as I said, you have a five-year-old with an adult male, and he tells her to do that in that moment. And a reasonable juror
she tells her what to do. Did mm-hmm. she also testify identifying what the it was for that act?
It was in the context of her. I don't have the exact the preceding testimony or the preceding statements, but I believe it was in the context of saying that he had, you know, when they were talking about having sexual contact with him and his spot and that sort of thing, and she said. I believe what she said was he wanted me to suck on his spot. And then she gave this particular quote saying he told me to suck on it like a sucker. So by context, it's clear what she was referring to.
But the record does not establish that he had at that point exposed himself. We would be left to an inference.
That's correct. That's correct. And I don't think that he would have had to have actually exposed himself to draw that to draw the inference that he was taking a substantial step. When they are in that situation, as I say, face-to-face, alone, in a bedroom, in the greater context of all this going on, I think that's still...
But if the words in context are enough, what changes it from everything else?
From everything else?
Yeah, I mean, if they were in the living room.
Mm-hmm.
If they were on the sidewalk.
Well, sidewalk is a little bit more tricky, but I think living room, if they were alone, you could draw the same inference.
Is it the relationship?
It's the relationship. It's the disparity in age. It's the fact that he has a supervisory relationship over her, everything. But in this context, when you say that to a five-year-old, I think a reasonable juror can find that's a substantial step. And again, you don't have to find that you yourselves would draw that conclusion or convict on this basis, only that a reasonable juror could reach that conclusion. It's sufficient to submit it to a jury. The question on the expert testimony, I'll turn to unless the court has any additional questions on this one. I don't think that the court has to reach that. Part of the problem...
Would it be helpful to reach that?
Part of the problem here, the answer would be no. And part of the problem is that the objections were, I think, unfounded and incorrect. And so there wasn't really a sufficient record developed as to what the correct objection had been made. I think that the objection that could have been made here is that it was improper opinion testimony. and/or that the testimony went so far as to require some sort of Fry determination, a Fry hearing. I don't think that's true.
Could it have been profile testimony?
Excuse me?
Could it have been profile testimony?
Well, I think that you could have made an objection along those lines, but I don't think that the testimony rose to that level. If you look to Black and Jones in those cases, those are cases where the expert testimony was saying, you can diagnose sex abuse if you have these four factors or five factors or seven factors. I don't remember how many there were. And this witness was not saying that. This witness was simply saying that from this long period of vaginal irritation that was observed and from this rapid increase in obesity, rapid increase in weight, that it was a red flag to possible sex abuse. That's it. She wasn't diagnosing sex abuse. She wasn't saying that from a set of criteria that you can diagnose sex abuse. She was saying that, in my experience, this is a very, very unusual set of circumstances, and it would raise a red flag for me. So that's far short of the types of testimony that was disapproved in the other cases.
Isn't that just inviting the jury to speculate as to causation?
I don't think it is, Your Honor. I think it is another piece of evidence that's relevant in this case. And so I think an objection could be made as to relevance and maybe even 403, but those objections weren't made. Even if they had been made, I think that given the limited nature of her testimony, all she's saying is that this raises a red flag. And I think it's reasonable for the jury to consider that. I'll also point out, though, that and I guess in some ways this cuts both ways, but it really wasn't the central issue in this case, whether this child had been abused. I think the central issue was, had this particular defendant done it? And I realize that might make it a little bit less relevant, but on the other hand, we always, I think, have the burden of proving to the jury that this happened, that this child has been abused, and limited testimony corroborating that is reasonable. But I just point that out as to the prejudicial effect, although I guess technically speaking, since it's being reversed anyway, that isn't squarely before you. The question is, did the trial court abuse his discretion in overruling these specific objections? I think the answer is no, and I don't think, given the limited nature of the record, it's helpful to try and give the court additional guidance on this. It can be re-raised in the trial court and hashed out at that point. We ask the court to reverse.
Thank you, counsel.
I just wanted to clarify one point in the record, which I think the state acknowledges. We don't have the time frame of when this happened in relation to the other allegations. She did say that she thought this might have happened in November, but then she also said she thought she told her grandmother about what happened before this. And so there's some confusion about when this happened. So I don't think this court can infer that this happened in the context of the previous happened after the previous allegations, and so then she knew what he was talking about, and there was perhaps some grooming or expectation that it would occur. The state is also asking this court to speculate that there was the coercion present, given his position of authority and whatnot, but we have her telling the forensic interviewer that, what did you do? I said no. What did he say? He said okay. And so we don't have, again, any type of conduct then trying to further that inappropriate statement to her. And I would point this court again to the White case, which is one that the state relies on in its briefing. And there the court recognized, that's the one where you have the boy in the bedroom watching TV. The defendant enters and grabs his butt and says a number of inappropriate things. But what the court said is that request for sexual gratification demonstrated his intent, and all those other actions demonstrated the substantial step, which is what we're missing in this case. I'll just touch briefly on the doctor's testimony. State versus Black recognized this type of general characteristics of sex abuse victims is inappropriate, in part because it constitutes vouching for the victim's credibility and basically implying that the defendant is guilty. We have a vouching objection from defense counsel, and so that particular issue is preserved and would be of benefit on remand for this court to provide guidance to the trial court as to what.
Well, I thought your argument on appeal was Fry. I don't recall reading about State versus Black except in my own mind.
There was both in there. Black certainly addresses Fry, as does the Jones case.
You cited Black?
Yes, did. Yeah. I agree that there's two arguments in that section. Obviously, I've discussed Fry in the supplemental briefing, but part of the problem with this testimony was specifically the vouching, which defense counsel lodged an objection on. So we'd ask this court to dismiss the attempt conviction reverse on the other. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The second matter today is State v.